I'm one of the two organizers of this conference, and we'll just say a very quick word of greeting, and then we'll go straight into the first session. The first and most important thing I have to announce is that the co-director of this conference, Andreas Meyer, is about to become a father later today.
And this is the
celebration of the time frame for the birth of his son. And so he had to leave Paris to go to Berlin just this morning. And he sends his greetings. We're very, very sorry to miss him here, but he may be here not just in spirit, but perhaps even in Skype tomorrow.
He's literally airborne for the time being.
It's probably, for the idea of a distant voice, it's not entirely appropriate. Wonderful event. Obviously, I also want to give our thanks to the University of Chicago Center for hosting us here in this wonderful place, to the director, Thomas Gravel, and to the organizer of events here, Sebastian Grupo. We also have had, as our program says, very generous institutional support, and I won't go through all of that, but we're very grateful for that. And again, just to say something which is already indicated in the program, the birth of this conference really came from the idea that the voices are the geographical and the cultural remoteness of the voice in some cases, the theoretical difficulty of the voice, the ephemerality and the transitory qualities of the voice, the distance and the particularity of voices has been a great inspiration for a great deal of intellectual activity. This is what we hope to carry on today. It's a source of great creativity and of interdisciplinary innovation. It's been a great source of cultural theory, and we have a wonderful set of speakers who will bring many different perspectives to this topic. There will be reasonable time for discussion at the end of each session, and we will be very much, as it happens today, in English, and very much tomorrow in French. So I think maybe just with those few words, I'll turn things over to Professor Chandler to introduce the first session.
Should I use this for purposes of the recording? Yes? Okay. So I'll add my welcome to Martin, send my thanks to Martin and Andreas and the other organizers of this event. It's great to be back at our center at the University of Chicago, where I've participated in several conferences over the years. When I first came, the Grand Moulin across the street was still a building in ruins. The Paris Diderot had not been created yet. So it's been wonderful to see these developments at the center. It's my pleasure to chair the first session of this conference, which is called Technique Vocale et Espace Scénique, Vocal Techniques in Theatrical Spaces. Though my sense is that, as with the other panels, these, and this is often the case with conferences, these rubrics for the different panels were developed after the fact. So I don't think you should think of the panels as recruiting papers to particular topics, which are their titles. These are very loose rubrics, and it may be that we find sources of thematic and methodological overlap between the papers of the different sections that don't coincide exactly with the announced topics. We have three excellent speakers for this first panel. And it's my pleasure, first of all, to address my colleague, to introduce my colleague at the University of Chicago, Sarah Neuter. Sarah is I'm going to be very telegraphic in these introductions. You're not here to hear me, you're here to hear these papers. Sarah is a classicist at the University of Chicago. She's been working on topics having to do with sound and voice for a very long time. Her first book is When Heroes Sing, Sophocles and the Shifting Soundscape of Tragedy. Cambridge University Press, 2012. She has since then been working on a number of other projects related to that one, The Mortal Voice and the Tragedies of Aeschylus, for example. I myself have heard her give a couple of wonderful papers having to do with the sounds and voices of Greek tragedy. She is, among other things, a veteran of our own voice project at the University of Chicago, and gave a different paper from the new project at our conference last year. So I'm very keen to hear what she has to say about the question of the mortal voice on the ancient Greek stage. Sarah.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks, Martin and Andreas. This is a paper about the outer limits of the human voice on the ancient Greek stage, as expressed by the breakdown of language into nonsense. Here I focus particularly on instances of such nonverbal vocalizing in Aristophanes and the Satyr play, as against a couple of moments of breakdown in tragedy, so as to consider the range of theatrical effects and implications that such vocalizations might have. Before I come to drama itself, however, let me pause to consider what is at stake in such instances of voicing from an ancient perspective. Plato's dialogue suggests that the act of mimetic voicing has a profound effect on those who hear these voices, but an even greater effect on the one who gives voice. His many objections to poetry, and especially drama, arise in part from the belief that what we utter makes us what we are, molding not only our own thoughts, but also our voices and bodies. He writes as much ventriloquizing through Socrates as usual in the Republic, and this is the first passage on the handout. Or have you not perceived that imitations, if they persist onward from youth, settle into characters and nature and body and voices and even in thought? Yes, even so, he said. The idea here is that voicing in the form of repeated imitations, and that's that word, mimesis, has power over the person who is voicing by impressing itself upon his character, by changing him. It is this power of the voice, when it is used for false voicing, that makes it so dangerous to a person's moral being. And a list follows of the people and things that must not be imitated by citizens of the ideal city, lest these citizens be influenced badly by such vocal pursuits. The list includes women of many sorts, such as those who are wrangling, defying their husbands, boasting, lamenting, sick, in love, or in labor. Also slaves, bad men, including cowards, drunkards, and madmen, and finally workers, like smiths, craftsmen, or rowers. The list of prohibited voices is capped by those of non-humans, including both natural phenomena and animals, and this is from handout 2. What then? Neighing horses and bellowing bulls and babbling rivers and the howling sea and thunder and all such things, will they imitate them? No. Rather, these will be off limits to them, he said, both to be mad and to act like madmen. Since it is vocal imitation that emits of these problematic sounds, only the very debased poet privileges it over narration to begin with, and this is the third handout. This is a description of the bad poet, quote, and so his style of speaking will derive entirely from imitation and voices and gestures, or will contain just a little bit of narration. Such sounds, then, really ought not to be espoused by the human voice or the body by way of gestures. If they are to be admitted to poetry at all, they should be distanced through the filter of narration, an element entirely missing from drama, whose absence renders drama inferior and indeed dangerous. In other words, the terrible power of drama arises from its use of false voice, voice that is not distanced from the speaker's identity through narration, and further from the potential for this voice to be deployed without speech or logos, in the form, for example, of a bull roaring. And this is the crux of the or of one problem for Plato. We have voices no less than other animals and with many of the same capabilities as theirs. Without the intervention of logos, that is speech, or the distance lent by narration, our bodies, speech, and thought may easily descend to the level of beasts with our souls tumbling down. To the dismay of Plato, Athenian playwrights did at times compel their actors to imitate animals' voices on stage and called for other vocalizations that are either lacking in logos or pointing away from logos in meaning and effect. And all this on top of the problem that these voices are not truly speaking from the actor's souls in any case. In The Laws, Plato's Athenian stranger again discusses the appearance of poetry in, quote, the cries of beasts and men, clashes of instruments, and noises of all kinds, end quote. And similarly, he disdains them. The muses, he asserts, would never combine the voices of beasts and men, whereas human poets, and these are all sort of quotes, human poets who senselessly weave together and completely confound these elements make laughingstocks of themselves and destroy music in their desire for, among other things, a beast-like voice. If to Plato or to his speakers, the effect of this non-linguistic voicing is at best clownish and at worst fatally corrupting, what is the counter-argument implicit in the use of such voices in Greek drama? What is gained when logos is lost? Aristotle echoes Plato, but with less apparent anxiety, in commenting that animals and humans share the capacity for voice, but not language. Even if some animals have voices, as he declares in the Politics, human voices are different from those of animals in that we use our voice, our phoné, to express structured speech or meaning. If Aristotle's perspective on human, on animal utterance as lacking in language but still possessed of voice can be taken as broadly representative of ancient views, then we can see how the use of animal vocalization on stage could be a way to highlight aspects of voice outside of its linguistic capacities. From animals and from humans at times, voice emerges as embodied, meaningful, and especially expressive, and the more so when it is non-linguistic. Non-lexical onomatopoeia is one example of this kind of vocalization. Such onomatopoeia is defined by Derek Attridge as, quote, the use of the phonetic characteristics of the language to imitate a sound without any attempt to produce recognizable verbal structures, end quote. This category includes, for example, mimicry of a dog barking, which in Greek is bau, bau. These non-lexical sounds sit at one end of a spectrum, the far end from the complex hypotactic structures that are often associated with poetic language in 5th century Athens. Yet alongside flights of syntactic complexity, drama includes such instances of aggressive sound play that logical meaning may seem at points to subside in favor of vocalized sound. Such a broad vocal spectrum allows playwrights to work with a great range of conceptions of human life and to pay particular attention to life on the edge of human experience. There is predictably both delight and despair to be found at these extremes, both verity and fragility. What we have of Aristophanes' forays into this field gives us a sense of the possibilities. One suggestive example comes from the birds, by way of a character who is a hoopoe. This bird is also a speaking character with a checkered mythical past as a former human king named Tereus. Early in the play, he summons other birds, the ones who will constitute the chorus, onto the stage in song. This is handout 4, so I'll try to give you a sense of the Greek. Epopopopoi, popopopopoi, popoi. Io, io, ito, 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 ito tis hote ton emon homopteron. So that's the sounds which become the sentence, let someone of my fellow feathered friends come forth. And then the second part is deuro, 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 toro, 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 cheeks, kikabao, kikabao, toro, 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 lililiks. And that's hither, 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 and then a bunch of bird sounds. Aristophanes plays with the notion of the bird's foreignness to speech and with the expectation of the audience as he backs the hoopoe's voice back and forth between speech and nonverbal sound. Initially, the hoopoe seems merely to repeat his own name, performing its onomatopoetic nature, since the word hoopoe in Greek is epops. But these pop noises soon shift to a phrase that is also linguistically coherent, with the sonic effects of the repetitions also greatly enhanced by the marked metrical variety of the hoopoe's song. So if you look at the Greek, you probably don't know Greek, but if you look at the Greek, you can see that you have these repeating syllables. In the second line, the e-o sort of fades into ito, which is an actual Greek word that means let him come, let somebody come. So you start in gibberish and it becomes language. The hoopoe's sound play with his own name also echoes a Sophoclean pun on the Greek word for hoopoe with the word observer in his tragedy Tereus, and this is handout 5. So the phrase is epoptein epopa, hoopoe observer of his own evils. This is an instance of aural wordplay that is unusually blatant for tragedy. In birds, then, the sound of the hoopoe's chirps not only mimics his own ornithological name and performs with metrical skill, but it also alludes to the tragic incarnation of the shape-shifting Tereus. The hoopoe's history and shifts in identities, dramatic genres, and life forms is thus signaled by his shifts between broken vocalizations and decipherable language. The hoopoe's next summon switches from coherent Greek, so that's the word deuro, which is a word in Greek that just means hither, to incomprehensible avian chirps. So deuro and toro sound very similar. Toro is not a word. None of everything after that first line is a word, a real word. And rounds off with the sharp X sound, teeks. The song then veers farther and faster into mimicry of bird sounds, from teeks to kikapau, which in ancient Scholius thought was intended to imitate the sound of an owl. This ends with the lililiks, which has been considered a fair attempt at a bird's cry. At the same time, however, the song cuts against straight mimicry with its formal poetic qualities, since the lililiks is a perfect anapest that rhymes very nicely with teeks. Thus, the hoopoe's patterns of song and speech again imply that he is caught between his original human nature and his new avian identity. Peisipyrus, the hero of the play, claims that this bivalent identity is an advantage, and explains to the hoopoe, quote, "You think all the things that a man thinks and as many things as a bird thinks." In much the same way, the birds who come to constitute the chorus have been taught the Greek language, but are still birds, as their ever chirpy patterns of speech demonstrate. And this is handout 6. Popopopopopopopumos ekalese, titi 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 tina logon arapote proseme filonechon. Where is he who has called me? What dear word then do you have for me? Like the hoopoe, the birds of the chorus are pulled in two directions. For them, the non-lexical stutters of bird sound, so that's the pa-pa-pa-pa-pa, not a word, indicate their automatic animal core, and the echoing words that follow show their training in human language. So pa-pa-pa, that's not a word, but poo is a word that means where, right? So the po's become poo, and then in the next line, ti-ti-ti-ti, not a real word, but it becomes tina, which means what? This comical state of limbo applies to many of the themes of the play, such as to the bird city suspended in the sky, and to Peisipyrus himself, who tries to be bird-like by acquiring wings, but remains staunchly human at heart. The birds then plays with the bending of ontological boundaries between these forms of life, but the incursions of nonsense into speech help to show that these boundaries remain nonetheless. When the birds later cohere into an actual chorus and acquire clear, fluent Greek, free of all chirps and stutters, they also develop the wherewithal to fulfill Peisipyrus' plan of taking over the universe. Their fragile grasp of human utterance at first makes them easy dupes for manipulation. Their subsequent hold on language puts them in a position of power on par with humans and ultimately with the gods. A more complex example of aural animal nonsense comes from Aristophanes' Frogs, a play famous for its focus on the powers of the stage and freighted with influence in the history of literary criticism. This play bears the unusual feature of having two consecutive choruses, with the first one constituted by the souls of swan frogs. Though they are known more commonly as frogs, their literal designation as swan frogs, of which there is no such thing, points to the joke of their presence, which is strictly aural. These frogs were probably heard but not seen on stage, and thus known only through the sound of their song. They proclaim themselves to sing beautifully in the manner implicitly of swans, but they are interpreted by Dionysus, the play's hero, as croaking disagreeable gibberish. When they sing in full sentences, their song is about the gods, activating the divine connotations of music. When they croak in a nonsensical mishmash of syllables, their sounds strike the ears of Dionysus, at least, as dissonance from the maws of beasts. Some of the humor in the scene obviously arises from the juxtaposition of high-handed musical rhetoric and croaky noise, language and voice at play. This chorus appear for just one brief interlude, the crossing of Dionysus to the far shores of Hades. Charon, chauffeur to the newly dead, presents the song of these frogs as a solution to the problem of Dionysus' self-professed inability to row the boat, which he claims with the declaration that he is, quote, inexperienced, unseafaring, and unsalamized. In Greek, that's aperos athalatatos asalamainos. The line whose combination in the Greek of assonance and aphoric alpha privatives and the asyndotonic tricolon of ascending silliness may signal the movement from representational sense into significant, if absurd, sound. Charon replies to Dionysus that it will be easy to row, for as soon as his oar strikes the water, he will hear most beautiful songs. Charon then identifies the swan frogs as the singer of these songs. The joke rests in the fact that song actually was used to regulate the rowing of triremes. Song is, at its most basic, the combination of rhythm and shifts in pitch. And an even rhythm, all apart from melody, sound play, or words, can have the literal effect in the world of compelling the acts of many men to fit together and fitting men into the world. Heron signals the frog's coming descent from linguistic sense into nonverbal voicing with his own final utterance before the frog's song. This is on your handout. It's oh up up, oh up up. A line that is probably best not rendered into English, but one translator has suggested heave ho, heave ho. Rhythm is on display for lampooning here, as well as the power of the voice through rhythm to organize, spur, and also simulate movement. So this is at the beginning of handout 7, and passages 7 and 8 are excerpts from a long song that's about 50 lines long. Obligingly, the frogs chime in. The first, second, and final line of their opening lyrical utterance is brekkekex coax coax. And this line is repeated throughout the call and response song that follows between the frogs and Dionysus. Dionysus is presented as an unhappy participant, both in the rowing and as an audience to the song of the frogs. And he responds to the frogs with ever more irritated cries of frustration. His complaints on the pain in his bottom caused by rowing interweave neatly with his complaints on the annoying sound of the frogs. The frogs continue blithely with their song, emphasizing its musical qualities and promoting it as sweet sounding. They then engage in some name dropping to puff up their divine connections, claiming to have sung in a festival for Dionysus himself, an odd note given that they are now singing to a disgruntled Dionysus on stage. They then suggest that they are beloved to the lyre-loving muses, to hoofed Pan, who plays the tunes of the reeds, and to the harpist Apollo because of their stewardship of the marsh reed, a physical necessity for the instruments of these gods. Thus, the frogs comically root their musical value in the material of the marshes. Dionysus and the frogs are paired off then as antagonists in a sonic battle. After cursing their coaxing and begging them to stop, Dionysus hits upon a new solution. He vows he will take their song from them. This is handout 8. He then assumes the frog's cry of brekkekex coax coax and sings to them in triumph that he will conquer them with the coax and forever keep them from the coax. So what he does is appends an article. In Greek, you can just add an article to any sound or any word and it becomes like a noun, basically. Thus, by appending and declining an article, Dionysus transforms and domesticates the non-lexical sound coax into a word coax, which metonymically represents the whole song and sound, and indeed the whole existence of the frogs. In effect, he turns the non-linguistic sound of coax into a perfectly semantically acceptable noun. Voice in his vocalization becomes language. Dionysus manages his transformation at the same time in the play that he starts to come into his identity and powers as a god, indeed as a god of theater and all such stage vocalization. To beat the frogs is to conquer sound with speech. Other examples from Greek drama show that such nonverbal expressions tend to appear when the poet is bringing attention to the body and the fragility of mortal existence, even when this corporeal fragility is humorous. I now turn briefly to satyr plays, a strange breed of romantic drama which were staged in Athens right after tragedies and written by the tragedians themselves. These plays, of which little still exists, all featured a chorus of satyrs with their leader Silenus, and drop this chorus into various sordid adventures. I have a picture of a satyr from a vessel on the last page of your handout. Mark Griffith has written that these satyrs, quote, engage the Athenian audience in an appealing fantasy, suggestive both of a return to childhood and of drunken revelry, end quote. A long fragment of one satyr play, Sophocles' Searchers, provides some basic examples of how nonverbal utterances are used. This passage gives us the chorus releasing ejaculations of surprise, hoo 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 hoo, and nearly unpronounceable expressions of fright, hoo hoo hoo, psst, psst, ah ah. These are in passage 9, which I'll come through in a moment. These kinds of vocalizations are indexes of not only emotions, but also internal bodily affairs. As such, they are sometimes called corporeal sound symbolism. They include everything from apparently spontaneous cries of emotion to the acoustics of digestion, right? Burps, hiccups, farts. Satyrs are above all corporeal beings, known for their addiction to bodily pleasures like drink and sex. These proclivities are visually marked by their prominent phalluses. The physicality of their language is underscored when they are ridiculed by Silenus, who suggests that they, quote, are lamenting in such cowardice and they will make a noise, which in this context, it uses a verb which just means making a noise, but means here to fart. The occasion of the satyrs' panic in the searchers makes their would-be farting all the more comic and absurd. Their alarm and the sounds that express it are provoked by their hearing the song of the lyre, a stringed instrument newly invented in the play by the lonely infant Hermes, who invents it, as we're told, as a source of comfort and pleasure for himself. And so this is passage 9 on your handout. So what we have is a long papyrus fragment, and some of it is broken up and illegible. And I've just taken bits from it. So everywhere you see those three dots is a break. So it's a non-continuous passage. So what you have is the chorus saying this, hoo, 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 and Silenus a little bit later says this thing, lamenting in such cowardice, he will make noise. And then a little later, the chorus says, hoo, 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 ps, ps, ah, ah, say what is the trouble. Why in vain were you screeching, shrieking, glancing at me suspiciously? Not clear who they're talking to. And then a little bit later, the chorus is talking to Kylene, who is the nurse of Hermes. And the chorus says, and how am I to believe that such a voice, a phlegma, which is the word for voice, shouts from a dead thing? And Kylene says, believe it, for though dead, it has a voice. Alive, for though dead, it has a voice. Alive, it was a voiceless beast. Chorus, with what name do you address it? Offer it if you know any more. Kylene, the child calls the beast a tortoise, and that which has a voice, a liar. Hermes is supposed to have, baby Hermes is supposed to have found a tortoise, scooped out the living part of it, and strung it with cow guts. That's how he makes the lyre. Kylene, and this is the cure and consolation of pain for him, the only one, and he takes pleasure in wandering about and voicing something in harmony with it. For it carries him away, the spangles of this lyre. So did the child contrive a voice for a dead beast. Chorus, some divine voice made by plucking has strolled about this place, and distinct apparitions flower up all over the land. As the satyrs learn more about the auditory sensation of the lyre, the vocabulary they use to describe its music changes. First, it is a sound, a psophos, and later is referred to as a divine voice, it's not in the Hindu, and then as the voice of a dead creature. Finally, when the satyrs understand the sound, they pronounce it an omphe, a word for divine voice used exclusively in Greek literature of authoritative utterance. One thing about Greek literature is that they have a very wide vocabulary for voice, many, many more words than we have. Thus, the chorus's earlier inarticulate vocal emissions, your hoo-hoo-hoos and such, not only result from, but also draw attention to the birth of a new sound, lyric music, that is imagined as born from a death, transforming a body from silent and bestial to melodious and divine. The satyrs, beast-like themselves, bring the corporeal excretory side of sound onto the stage, just as the divine lyre can also be heard, and perhaps undercut by vocalizations of the body. Yet at the same time as these low corporeal emissions are juxtaposed with the melodies of the lyre itself is posed as a double juxtaposition of voice. Divine sound sings from a dead, previously dumb beast, and an inarticulate child makes song blossom through the land. In tragedy, predictably, the role of nonverbal nonsense diminishes, and the voicing of animals is almost never found, although there are nonetheless hints of proximity to the world of animals and infants wherever vocal nonsense intrudes. Here, the reduction of voice to nonsense supplies a way to convey the razor-sharp edge of human experience, suffering that is so extreme that sufferers depart from the realm of representational language. Unlike the mimicry of birds' songs and frogs' croaks, these vocal expressions are not icons or imitations of anything. Rather, they are indexes of pain in the broken voices of characters who are otherwise pointedly articulate. This departure from verbal language becomes the most revealing aspect of such passages, the very fact that the speaker cannot maintain the business of grammatical, lexical constructions, or manages to return to language only by force of a repressive will. They are drawn into the material of vocalization to display materiality and indeed the mortality underlying their embodied existence. In Agamemnon, we see voice expressed with an incisive lack of articulation when Cassandra begins her song with apparently inarticulate cries of grief. Yet these soon metamorphose into addresses to Apollo and then become a still echoing but now lucid statement of despair. And this is handout 10. So she begins with, Ototutoi popoida, opalon, opalon. Ototutoi popoida, opalon, opalon. Opalon, opalon, aguiat, apalon emos. So again, we start with just syllables, that's in italics in the English, and then, oh Apollo, oh Apollo, oh Apollo, and so on. God of my avenues, my Apollo, you have destroyed me, not partially and for a second time. This progression of sound into sense is not dissimilar to the one performed by the hoopoe and the chorus of birds in Aristophanes' Birds that I discussed before. Cassandra's cries of popoi fade into the coherent O Apollo, right? So popoi sounds like O Apollon, and then into my Apollo, which transforms again into the stark verbal declaration, you have transformed me, you have destroyed me. So you have destroyed me is the verb in the last line, apolesas, right? So the apo is coming right out of the name Apollon. The first two lines are repeated as an echoing refrain of ot, op, and pol, but these sounds change through puns into the name Apollo, and then into the verb, you have destroyed me. The bird sound play in Aristophanes' Birds is played for laughs. This one shows with searing clarity Cassandra's movement from the terrifying interiority of her mind into the lucidity of conversant language. These utterances occur soon after Clytemnestra suggests that a Cassandra must have, quote, an unknowable foreign voice in the manner of a sparrow. A little later, Cassandra calls herself a nightingale, who pronounces the name of her lost son, Itus Itus, the name itself a sound that has become a symbol, or vice versa. There is some play in these moments with the idea that Cassandra is more animal than woman, more a maker of sound and song than a speaker of speech. Indeed, Cassandra is commonly understood to dwell at a focal point between identities. Unmarried maiden and yet consort to Apollo, Agamemnon, Hades, prophetic yet pathetic. Here in Aeschylus's rendering, she acquires also the ambiguities available in voice, as her words are revealed to be nonsensical, yet incomparably fluent in lyricism and metaphor. And all this from a girl who speaks like a bird. Aeschylus makes use of the edges of logos, speech, to allow phoné, or voice, to a surface. Sophocles' hero, Philoctetes, also stands out as a flamboyant vocalist of nonsense and the most sustained sufferer of physical pain on the Greek stage. He is also one of the most vocably variable of tragic characters, capable of expressing his position in a panoply of speech, song, and marked linguistic devices. Yet he is never more striking than when his language breaks down into the apparently non-lexical, as in the following passage, and this is handout 11. So here he is with a young man, Neoptolemus, and he has an attack, his foot is diseased, and he has an attack of pain in his foot, which he tries to suppress. He tries to keep Neoptolemus from seeing. So I won't read the whole thing, but he starts out with these cries, ah, ah, ah. Neoptolemus tries to figure out what's going on, and he tries to tell him it's nothing. And that goes on for some time. And then he can no longer suppress it. He says, I am destroyed, child. I will not be able to hide this from you. Atatatai, I am wretched. I am destroyed. I am being eaten alive, child. And then he has this line of sounds. Papai, papapai, papa, papa, papa. Do you understand, O child? And so on. Papapapapai. The extreme quality of Philoctetes' suffering is expressed by his inability to suppress these incredible processions of sound. How shocking would these sounds have been to an Athenian audience? How much a break from sense and meter? The opinions of different editors of this text are instructive here, for we see the limits of our ability to answer even these most basic questions. Seth Shine asserts that Philoctetes' cries of ah-ah-ah are extra metrum, or non-metrical. Right? All tragedy is in meter, so that would be a big departure. But Webster, T.L. Webster, insists that they are segments of an iambic line and prints the text accordingly. These editorial choices themselves indicate different notions of the limitation of vocal expression in Greek tragedy. All commentators agree that the most notorious series of cries, papaya, papapaya, papapa, 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 is also perfectly iambic. But Richard Jebb and Shine both tease out more complex forms of sense from this senselessness, with Jebb connecting the final four papas into an unbroken string and noting that if read this way, the sounds form an ascending tricolon of agony. So you have ever-lengthening papai forms. Shine, for his part, draws attention to how Philoctetes' cries of papai fit with the language and themes of the play. Quote, Philoctetes' cry conspicuously reiterates sounds suggesting pais, which is the Greek word for child, and papas, father, papa. Yet this interpretation threatens to suppress the destruction wrought on language in the passage, in the complementary drawing of attention to the material and mortal voice here. A listener, no less than a commentator, may well be tempted to try to piece together logical meaning from these broken syllables. What results is a variety of plausible ways of reading and experiencing this vocal flight that invite further questions. is Sophocles showing how pain compels speakers to shatter the boundaries of sense and turn to the expressivity of nonsense, or that even in this break from sense, the semantic and poetic structures of sense building remain intact? Either way, Philoctetes allows the audience to dwell in the experience of voice overwhelming language, hearing its materiality as expressed by several series of popping labials in which one can probably hear the words father, papas, and child, pais, roles that will lead the protagonist back to coherence and ultimately back to society through his paternal and filial relationships with other characters. Such desperate moments in tragedy reveal an ongoing state of vulnerability that is intrinsic to mortality itself and reminds us that our semantically rich locutions can dissolve into the babble of vocalization at any time, a babble that has no Aristophanic glee about it at all. And yet there is a point of connection between the gibberish of the birds and the cries of Philoctetes. For Philoctetes, as in most distraught, screams like a beast in pain, but also as Shine notes, like a baby calling for its father, papa, papa. These are the very syllables earmarked by Theophrastus some 100 years later as a paradigmatic manner of conversing with an infant, with a P sound standing out most prominently in the Greek. This is handout 12. You can just see in the second line this phrase, which means clucking and calling the baby his little knave, his little criminal. Popuzon kai pornugi tu papu kolon. In fact, any string of repeated syllables might call to mind the babble of babies, for whom voicing chains of repeating syllables is a standard method of language acquisition. For babies, of course, have no language, only voice. This state of infancy contains both the capacity and the lack that we lose as we acquire language, with the number of phonemes we are able to decipher and produce radically diminishing in the first months and years of life. Alongside our babble in infancy is a complete alignment of body and self, with nary a dishonest or evasive utterance escaping our infantile mouths. This alignment of body, voice, and truth is, as we know, completely lost later in life, a loss that perhaps allows for the sense of fascination or even longing felt in the presence of inarticulate human voices. Is babble, nonsense, and gibberish, then, always just beneath the surface of language, or is it the sound of something lost? I have been speaking of logosless vocalization as an ever-present potential, but it may also remind us that there is, in fact, nothing truly ever-present about us. By the time a person is able to notice that babble or non-lexical communication exists in a separate sphere from semantically communicative language, he is no longer a baby himself and is rarely called upon to produce or take note of voice apart from language. Thus, babble, pure non-semantic phoné, is more often observed than emitted by those who do observe it. It is largely a capacity of our children, not of our grown selves. It represents a stage that we have lost, that we understand as usually fleeting. One is reminded of Mladen Dolar's evocation of infant and parent communication, in which he notes that babies do not only imitate adults, as is often suggested, but rather, quote, the opposite. Adults imitate children. They resort to babbling in what is no doubt a more successful dialogue than most, end quote. What makes such co-babbling seem successful is the sense that one has gotten beneath the evasions and circularities of language, dug down to a Rousseauian ideal of pure communication, pure existence, and pure being that cannot last. Aristophanes, clearly aware of the attractions of pre-verbal communication, has his character Strepsiades, father of an adult son, reminisce nostalgically about just such an exchange in the clouds. And this is handout 13. Whenever you said brew, I understood and would offer something to drink. When you asked for mama, I would come bearing bread. Brew and mama are nonsense words. In clouds, this striking and even touching memory of perfect communication arising from half-baked childish vocalization contrasts sharply with the mess of meanings made by the sophisticated methods of rhetoric, that is logos, which are personified and skewered later in the same play. Aeschylus, too, was not deaf to the cries of children. His mostly lost satyr play, The Net Haulers, includes apparent stage directions surrounding the interchange of Silenus and a baby Perseus, trading such alliterative and infantile terms as papas and papousmos. Like other thinkers in antiquity, Aeschylus suggests that babies' cries are similar to the howls of beasts, yet he includes them in his dramas as one form of vocalization that is untainted by language. The second play of the Oresteia contains a rather long and strange speech from a nurse on the travails of caring for babies who cannot speak to communicate the needs of their bodies. And this is an excerpt on passage 14. For it is necessary to nurse a baby as if a non-thinking thing, like a beast. How else? In whatever way his mind goes. For a child in swaddling clothes cannot yet say anything if he is hungry or thirsty or needing to pee. A newborn belly in children goes its own way. This description of a baby as a beast comes in the midst of a lament. The baby Orestes, whose infant shrieks she just recalled, is now a grown man whom the nurse believes to be dead. She recollects Orestes, the infant, as fully known to her through his body, pushed along by the independent powers of his belly, and unable to speak as a person, although she has just mentioned his wails. Her account rolls longing for Orestes as an infant into grief for the death of Orestes the adult, and thus evokes the implications of time and loss implicit in any memory of voice as such. In closing, I would suggest that staging the most material and thus embodied quality of voice is a means of grasping at some most intrinsic part of the human experience. Paying attention to the embodied mortal voice in ancient drama is, at its most successful, a means of recovering a living expression of vocal sound, and yet it is also an acknowledgement that these voicings are trapped in time and lost in the past. We cannot nail down the voices of the stage or define them, yet we should not dismiss them. Cicero cites Demosthenes as being asked the most important element of oratory and answering delivery, and then giving the same answer for the second and third most important elements too. As Shane Butler writes in this passage, quote, delivery more or less definitionally comprises those parts of an oratorical performance that cannot be transcribed, end quote. In this way, delivery is precisely the aspect of Greek tragedy we do not have and could not keep even if we had experienced it, a fact that holds true for all perceptions of voice. Drama combines the fleeting temporality of existence with the corporeality of actual people on a stage. Its offering of presence and forthcoming absence in the form of sound and forthcoming silence is an apt analogy for the experience of having, if briefly, a mortal voice. Thank you.